Okay, this is the sixth session, session six, side one of the first tape, and we're now going into the McLuhan quadrant again. We did LaRouche at the end of the previous session, so we're on page seven, and the top quote is something to be read by Scott. This is from Gutenberg Galaxy, page 44, written, and the book was published in 62.
This externalization of our senses creates what Chardin calls the new sphere, our technological brain for the world. Instead of tending towards a vast Alexandrian library, the world has become a computer, an electronic brain, exactly as in an infantile piece of science fiction. And as our senses have gone outside us, Big Brother goes inside.
Okay, so you want to say something about it?
Yeah. First, I'd like to, if Chardin conceptualizes the new sphere.
That's Teilhard de Chardin.
Yeah. And McLuhan amplifies it by saying, or technological brain for the world. Well, isn't McLuhan saying... wouldn't that be a metaphor for what McLuhan is trying to point out, that we are inside of a technological brain? That's what the extensions of man are.
Right. But you think that McLuhan is to be identified with the concept.
Well, I'm wondering, how do we distinguish Chardin's new sphere from what McLuhan is trying to point out?
Here's how you distinguish it. McLuhan did not put any value judgments on the technological brain or noosphere. He watched the effects of it. He did not want to be considered the inventor of the idea. Many people before him, especially Wyndham Lewis and Joyce, and who was it? The guy who did The House of the Seven Gables. I think it's Melville. Melville wrote in 1860, there's a line in there, he talks about the world becoming a technological nerve. So he picked that up from the Telegraph that quickly, 100 years before McLuhan was popular. So you can track through people who understood we were in an electronic brain. That's why he calls it infantile piece of science fiction. It was cliche science fiction as a notion, as an idea, as a concept in McLuhan's time. But nobody thought about looking at the effects of it. Most people thought it was a dystopian or a utopian situation, but McLuhan saw it as a product of the electronic technologies, and he would watch the effects of it on older technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the social drama, the effects of all that would be create a social drama that he would then respond to in a Manippean satire when he was writing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was talking about it, being interviewed about it, he would try to offer a way of managing it. So most people wonder or claim that McLuhan got the idea of extensions of man from Bucky Fuller or from Edward T. Hall or from Teilhard de Chardin. Even Tom Wolfe emphasizes the de Chardin connection. But they miss the point. McLuhan is looking at why people believe there is a technological brain. What is it in experience that makes people accept that idea as a plausible image of the future? So he's not to be identified with the notion. He's to be identified with the strategy of responding to people who think that.
Mm. Yeah.
And he said one of the effects he has in the last line, as our senses have gone outside, as Big Brother goes inside. He's presenting a whole new level of what Orwell popularized as Big Brother. He's saying Big Brother's doing something different than what Orwell predicted.
Mm-hmm.
Or one could say the fact that there was a secret world government, that was Big Brother going inside. So McLuhan's saying what Orwell came up with was a product of the electronic age. But he also means something else, because two quotes down, he says not Big Brother is watching, but all the brothers. So he knows there's more to understand the visual space bureaucracy that we described in the previous quote about the portrait of the Countess of Meath,
mm-hmm.
back, 1700s. That Big Brother, what Foucault calls the panopticon, taking it from Jeremy Bentham, 1800, the British philosopher, his notion of the as a warden of a jail, being able to be in the center of the jail and see all the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
That was called the panopticon. That is generally what people think the Big Brother is. It's like a visual projection. But McLuhan knew Big Brother was gone way more subtle than that. And he said in the late 60s, early 70s, that Big Brother was the Nielsen ratings, not some guy sticking a rat into another guy's face, like at the end of 1984. Right?
Yeah. My idea of Big Brother would be more like Nazi Germany, where, or some eras of the former Soviet Union, where they create a propaganda machine that causes everybody to be watching everybody else. The government doesn't even have to be watching everybody, because they have people conditioned to turn their own parents in. Everybody's watching everybody else. Now, that's a Big Brother. But if you try to look at Big Brother as, well, the government is watching us, well, you know, the government can't watch us. There's too many of us, and there's too much going on. So that would be my idea of Big Brother.
Okay, then we'll call that generating paranoia,
mm-hmm.
fragmenting social paranoia, right? Everybody is really just concerned about their own welfare and will turn in anybody else.
Right.
We could take that paranoid situation, which is in the Big Brother quadrant in my chart, is the LaRouche quadrant, which is the holopathic satellite radio, and that is paranoia. Paranoia is in that quadrant. So let's look at that, accept that definition. And McLuhan says, and as our senses have gone outside us, Big Brother or paranoia goes inside. And that's the paranoia of figuring out whether someone has the right emotional health. And that would bring in the therapeutic dominance of the psychiatric and later psychotherapeutic professions. It's like a monitoring of the emotional condition inside. So paranoia goes inside rather than outside. Outside would be, you know, Genghis Khan coming in and then wiping out the town. But this, now that we're inside our central nervous system, the conditions of our inner states is what Big Brother massages.
Mm-hmm.
So the paranoid condition is inside, rather it's in the mind, rather than in worrying about someone shooting you or someone just killing you and stealing your property.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So physical, it's like the old... And the Nazis, they both were pretty murderous, Stalin and Hitler. They did both. They made people paranoid, and they also killed a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, McLuhan said that it was all caused by radio. Radio created all kinds of responses in all kinds of different cultures, and two of the responses are known as Nazism and Stalinism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there were other responses, like Mao Zedong or FDR.
I have a new... The percept of the radio is creating that kind of warfare, World War II. I thought of another way of looking...
The economic collapse first.
Yeah.
The boom in the economy, the world economy in the 20s, could not be contained by the 19th century bureaucracies, by Big Brother, so they went into a depression, and they had to have a war to get out of the depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Well... An idea that I have about that radio created World War II is that I'm thinking of a stage show I saw one time where a hypnotist brought people up on the stage and he got them to suspend their conscious mind so that he could speak directly to their subconscious. And the subconscious is like a machine. It just reflexively responds to whatever commands are being given. So he speaks in an authoritarian way, gives a set of directions directly into the subconscious mind of the people on the stage, and they just act out whatever he says to do. And the radio, since it amplified the ear to the exclusion of the other senses, I could see people sticking their ear to the radio and being in awe of this new technology, suspending their conscious mind and allowing whatever the radio says to go right into the subconscious, and then they just line up and just like the stage hypnotist, start acting out what they're being told to do. And Hitler got on there in an authoritarian way and told them what to do.
Right, but don't think of the radio as in the ear. It massages the central nervous system like the telephone does. There's no ear once you have a radio environment. There's no chemical body. That's been melted away, and you're now on the inside of what becomes the TV body. You're in an internal ganglion landscape. And so you talk about the subconscious. Well, the central nervous system and the fact that it's massaged and numbed by the radio environment, that's what I would define as a subconscious. And language can work on that. So the content of radio is language. Language is, the radio is not an extension of language. It's an extension of the central nervous system. And the content, therefore, to be played with like a game, is the world of speech. And that's what Hitler and the demagogues did. They didn't mean what they said, but they could make people live in a dreamland, being forced to respond to the language that they implemented and you had to align with. That was the content of the radio environment. The form, the fact that everybody was inside the central nervous system, like a cubist painting or a surrealistic painting or a dadaistic environment, those were artists trying to express the apparently absurd central nervous system effect. That creates the paranoia when you don't have a body as you understood it as your ground.
Mm-hmm.
So the words ride and surf on top of that ocean of silence or paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
So the management of words, which was called propaganda, and that's what McLuhan said the tradition of rhetoric came back.
Yeah.
It was massaging of people's chemical body.
Yeah.
The image they had of the chemical body and its needs in a very tyrannical, conformist way. So that was easy to manage once you had a radio environment, because radio was the subconscious effect. And that subconscious effect was paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine people, think of Victorian people, think of British people. Someone asked me today, who's the most visually biased culture? Well, the British are. And they have a very stilted interaction socially. That stilted British nature, stilted from the point of view of other cultures, they don't think they're stilted. That stilted nature, where it's based on the eye, and everybody is like a billiard ball, and you keep your distance by being polite and uniform on the surface, all of a sudden that's gone away, and you're all inside a beehive. Whatever image you want to think of being imploded, the body is erased. That's a huge apocalyptic violence to inflict on a population compared to any other images of Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you had these mass wars for part of the 20th century. That was the effect of radio.
And, the United States being built up printing press, it probably was less of a hidden ground, and maybe that's why they were more visual biased in Europe, because the printing press was more of a hidden ground.
For the Europeans.
For the Europeans.
Yeah, the Americans, you know what it did? It actually, some people think, right, back then, or in the 60s, they said, it had a positive effect. It brought in the New Deal. It made Americans begin to realize they weren't isolated visually or kinetic biased individuals, that they were in a tribe. And the tribal awareness that radio caused in the more literate populations, like or more industrial populations of England and the United States, especially the States, they brought in the New Deal. And they even had socialist government in the 30s in England. So the new tribal togetherness, what was called fellow travelers, that was a new form of consciousness for Americans, which was very un-American. And there were visual biased wealthy oligarchs and bureaucrats who were outraged at FDR and tried to have a coup in 1934, the circle around DuPont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the visual culture was, and kinetic culture was made very nervous about this new tribal togetherness.
Yeah. But then also, when you interviewed Croker on Eben's show, and he points out that America was built on the Puritan ethic, well, the Puritan ethic comes out of visual space. There's a bit of a contradiction there with what you're saying.
Well, by Croker.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Croker's not following McLuhan.
Oh. So you think...
He doesn't map on McLuhan stuff as I'm doing. But I can explain, I can map McLuhan onto what Croker's saying. The visual bias that he sees in the Puritan culture, yes, the Puritans came over in 1600. There wasn't a kinetic industrial culture yet. So the Puritan visual British culture comes into the United States. And for the first 100 years or so, it is a visual culture. It's British. But when they start getting the manufacturers going and getting industry going, 1760s and 70s and 1780s, it became different from England. England was being industrialized too, but there was no feudal backlog. So you could take on the new kinetic industrial effect, mix it with the visual, and that made the uniquely distinct American character, which is different from the British character. So Croker is noticing the Puritan retrieval. And one could say that in the post, what I would say, in the post-information culture, where everybody is beyond cohering in a group communication, that the new AP caveman quality that comes up is in the West largely eye-oriented or visual. So the Bush retrieved the caveman visual culture, and that may be due to the post-information society we're in, or it is the last gasp of America's looking for an identity profile, and they're going back to their roots in visual space and waking up this Puritan culture, the neo-Puritans with the Bush administration. So you can see that whatever one calls the Puritans, you can see that they are, in McLuhan terms, visually biased, and for some reason, that visual bias, that part of the American makeup, is what seems to be screaming out for identity right now and recognition. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe since America went through the industrial kinetic phase, then moved into the software phase, where the kinetic falls away to the tactile, that when you're in a tactile mishmash of the global membrane, then the Americans can only fall back on the eye. And another reason they might fall back on the eye is that many people think that the Android meme in this digital era is largely eyeballs. It's largely eye and visual culture, especially for the West. So Americans come up with their Puritan background in response to the Internet and the Android meme as we presently experience it under Microsoft conditions. That may be largely the eye bias of the Internet. The Americans respond by bringing in their eye roots, the Puritan. There's a book written by David Schenck, middle 90s, and he said that the Internet favors Republicans. So I would put in the McLuhan level and say the apparently visual effect of the Internet, because you're getting a lot of eyeball data, but people get sound and video, but for Americans, they think the media, this world we live in today, they say it's a highly visual culture. So why not get that part of the American constituent to resonate with it, and that's the Puritan background. That's where I would adapt Croker back to McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Croker may not accept that.
Mm-hmm.
He has his reasons. I mean, he's quite paranoid about the Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
At least that essay seems to point that out, that he thinks this is pretty pretty perverse. He calls them panic pagans.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. He calls them pagans. He doesn't really think they're Christians, though the Puritans think they're Christians.
Right. Yeah. Well, he's getting at the sore that Hollywood reacts to when they try to bash the Republicans, but they don't know why they're so upset. So they just try to come up with reasons.
No, okay. No,
I'm saying Croker is getting closer to why Hollywood liberals, what they're reacting against, but can't articulate it like Croker does.
Hollywood Babylon is reacting to the Puritans.
Yeah.
And Croker is explaining what the Babylonian Hollywood sees. He says they see Puritans.
Yeah.
And he seems to agree with them. That's why he's in the L.A. quadrant, Little Murray and Los Angeles quadrant. And movies are his supplementary medium on the chart.
Mm. Cool. So what was Chardon's concept of the new sphere? I didn't know Chardon that I didn't look at him that much. But I always thought he was talking about some kind of collective unconscious sort of organizing itself in some symbiotic and balanced way such that, you know, we move into the golden age and everybody's happy or something. Or everybody, or there's a world that works for everybody, like Bucky Fuller talked about. But McLuhan's associating his idea of the new state with the technological brain.
Right, the reason. Because Desjardins defined electricity as a new biological event. Mm. He was understanding that technology and nature were merging.
Mm, yeah.
And so many people think McLuhan either ripped that idea off of Desjardins or independent Desjardins developed it. The point is that McLuhan didn't either. He studied the effects of people who thought that's what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he thought and studied the effects on other media. But no, technological brain for the world is a very accurate description of Desjardins. Desjardins of his concept of the noosphere. But Desjardins may have all kinds of other notions of what this would lead to in terms of culture and religion and the Vatican and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that might have been Desjardins' attempt to look at the effects.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan wasn't too interested in that. So he's just pointing out that someone else noticed the merger of technology and nature,
mm-hmm.
creating an imploded central nervous system, and it was called noosphere. So it wasn't anything Jungian. Sounds like when you first started this question.
Right.
It wasn't Jungian.
Mm.
McLuhan is correct. They're accurate in reference to Desjardins' notion when he says it's not.
Right.
Jungian.
Right. Yeah. Okay. In the next sentence where he says, instead of tending towards a vast Alexandrian library, the world has become a computer, an electronic brain, exactly as an infantile piece of science fiction. Now, there's McLuhan's sort of dry sense of irony, I don't know if you call it Mundian satire, where he's saying that this is the way it's becoming, as though he's making a statement, and then he dismisses it by calling it an infantile piece of science fiction.
Right, because it's just he's not talking about the concept. He's talking about studying the effects of it on other media. Okay, so he says, first of all, technological brain for the world. He knows in the 40s and 50s, people think brainy people read books, are bookworms.
Mm-hmm.
So he thinks if you have a brain of the world, technological brain, it's a vast Alexandrian library. That's the projection of visual space.
Right.
That's actually the 19th century.
Yeah,
now
I got
changed,
you.
What?
I said, I got you.
Yeah, and, you know, all the books in the 19th century. And see, so he's trying to correct your image of what's going on here, your percept. So he just says, instead of tending towards a vast Alexandrian library with all this information, technological brain, the world has become a computer. It is the image of the world has merged with the computer effect, an electronic brain, exactly as in an infantile piece of science fiction. That proves to you, if you think he's impressed with the idea that we have a computerized world brain, then that shows you have to deal with that last clause where he says, it's not ironic, he's trying to point to you that he's not concerned about the image that the new technology evokes.
Mm.
He's given an example of someone who did get evoked, and that was Desjardins, and it was already evoked in science fiction of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that, what McLuhan is really going to talk about, he's going to spend the rest of his book writing and explaining why the technological brain is an infantile image.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's going to take a little work to whittle away and get that all worked out clearly in my mind, because it does seem like we live in a vast Alexandrian library. I want to find out some information on anything. I Google it, I get the information. It's a lot. Vast Alexandrian library at my fingertips, and then McLuhan is trivializing that and saying that's infantile science fiction notion.
It's not at your fingertips. It's inside you. Think of visual space as Big Brother. The Alexandrian library has gone inside of you, and he's saying it's not a vast external space. It's an internalized space. It's a brain. It's all in your brain. So, how do you image that repository of information? Can't call the library. You can just describe the action of the process, which is, quoting you, at the tip of my fingertips, I can get any piece of information. No piece of information, you know, a little sound bite, a little visual print bite. That is not the world we live in. That is an effect of one of the technologies. But the world we live in is the interplay of all the technologies leading to the sound bite disappeared world. And so it's not something that's visible. You engage with little sound bites, visual bites, eye bites of information as part of the economy for your chemical body. But the ground of all that is a disappeared library, even on the inside. Because every minute there's new bits of general patterns given out by news agencies, which have a short lifespan, and then there's a, like a palimpsest, they're erased, and something's written over them. Then something's written over that. Eraser head. We live in an eraser head more than an electronic brain. And this may be what Lynch was getting at. Wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't trying to... I wouldn't be surprised if I was told he was trying to process McLuhan in his early movies, and even after.
He's kind of... I think he puts a morbid spin on things that I don't think McLuhan would agree with.
Oh, McLuhan would agree with the disservices. When you look at the disservices, Lynch is timid compared to the morbidity McLuhan evokes. Remember, you brought up Hitler and Stalin. McLuhan said that the world of today was run by people who were 100 times worse than Hitler or Stalin. Now, we wake up as entertainment and politics and showbiz that they're the worst guys that ever happened. Stalin, 30 million people. Hitler, 6 million people killed. And we say that's the ultimate evil. But McLuhan's come on, no. You're unaware of the fact that this world has been totally amputated, disappeared, and the managers who work within that and don't try to get us out of that are far worse than guys who just killed the chemical body. McLuhan's saying the TV body was being killed. So you see my point? That's way beyond Lynch's travesty or Lynch's morbidity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I didn't get your last statement, the TV body's being killed.
Oh, yeah. The TV body was moved into the chip body. The TV body was there, or the TV landscape, before it became a body, was there, and there was a huge disrespect of where it was leading. And when the chip world started to come in with the 60s, the TV landscape was obsolete. Became a golden art form. And turned the chemical body into a ghetto. The TV body is now a ghetto. The chip body is the art form. The hidden new ground is, you know, cold fusion, the post-information, post-chip body world. But we're witnessing, you know, the biblical apocalypse or the Armageddon of the Book of Revelation. It's just describing problems for the chemical body. It doesn't deal with the disaster to the TV body. The TV environment has a lot of services, but we can't appreciate what it can do anymore because it's been obsolesced by the chip landscape.
And then there's rumble. Are you scratching is your mouth touching your mouthpiece? Or there's rumbling going on. It's distorting what you're saying.
No. Could that be the fan? Oh.
Yeah.
That's the wind from the fan.
Yeah.
I'm too close to the fan. So did distort the last 20 minutes?
Well, you could hear it. It just was a distraction.
Yeah. Okay. It's not there now, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I'm sort of standing away from it. Now, what? So the...
No, but we never realized the services of the TV body. It got killed before it was ever gave us whatever services it had to give.
No, it gave all kinds of services. It got people out of visual space hypnotism. It toppled the biases of the 19th century, created new enthusiasms and lots of new imagery and new kinds of movies, new kinds of music. All kinds of things happened.
Yeah.
But then we didn't stop it. We didn't modulate it.
Yeah.
And therefore, we moved into the digital and the chip zone, and... then the TV body just becomes an artifact of comfort and nostalgia.
Yeah.
And so what are the services? Are we taking advantage of the services of the chip body? Well, certainly with a lot of services in the 90s in terms of the economy, but we overdid it and it collapsed.
Mm.
Now we're experiencing the dystopian disservices of the chip body.
Mm-hmm.
Economically, outsourcing.
Yeah.
Politics is cultural... aggression, tribal isolation, all effects of the chip landscape. Now, when I say body, that is the progressive shrinking of these huge landscape kind of environments to the point where people, the human being, feel superior and can control these previous huge landscapes. At that point, I call them bodies. Like I can manipulate my body, right? I can manipulate the radio landscape in the 30s and 40s. But I can manipulate the radius landscape now like it's an arm.
Because you have more stations to choose from?
No, because I can click it on and off, and the effects of the radio environment don't have any impact anymore, like they did in the 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. I couldn't deal with the... I was just an automaton. Everybody was an automaton in the collective electric landscape of radio.
Yeah, you could turn off your personal radio, but you were still part of the social network that was being affected and the culture
right.
that was being affected by it.
And those were the older media landscapes, like the economy. You had a massive depression. The collapse of visual space management of money. Right? That was an effect of radio. So now we don't have radio. We don't have TV. We don't have a chip. We have a seamless web where I can sort of experience phantoms and specters of those previous huge environments. So I can click on a bit of music, MP3 it, then zip over some video, then read something, then ignore that and do some yoga or run around the block or go out and take dope or go work at a job, then come back. You know, it's, I mean, the radio industry itself is so fragmented. As an old medium, they don't have the top 40 radio format anymore. It's just whatever they can find, what audience they can get temporarily.
Yeah.
And advertising is the thing that holds that together. So that's why Big Brother, in terms of maintaining social order, advertising serves as that role. Because there is no social order possible, as cultures understood social order, today at all. So we have an approximation of social order, which is the Nielsen ratings, which tell you which... That allows you to have a hierarchy of wealth based on the Nielsen ratings. So to the degree that Big Brother is visual hierarchy or bureaucracy, that's why it's Big Brother. The Nielsen ratings.
Mm-hmm.
They're the things that create social order in the massive media environment.
Right.
You got a big show, all the ads will come and pay for it. You don't, you're canceled. Right?
Yeah. Right.
And that's a sense of order for the old TV landscape.
Yeah.
Now just a body. I mean, kids don't even interact too much with television as a serious environment anymore. They're in a place called MySpace. You ever heard of MySpace?
Oh, yeah.
So it's obsolescing Google. Everybody, all the big producers and agents and actors and people in the TV landscape are in MySpace, putting up their media ads and seductions.
That is advertising, advertising, advertising. One of the reasons why MySpace is exploding onto the scene is because people are talking about it on the radio and on the TV, and that's driving more people to go find out what it is.
That's right. The my chart is a picture of MySpace. Rumpelstiltskin, which the Android meme makes you think you can control your media diet, your media bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It's your space. So there it is. MySpace is on the chart 10 years ago. And let's see, MySpace is the Rumpelstiltskin for everybody, and it is a technological fact. It's almost like everybody was Rumpelstiltskin already, but this guy, I think his name's Tom something, he organized it that, okay, we will make your little video. We will make your little sound bites, your little radio songs, your little newspapers, your little designs. We will do all the old media operations for you. You don't have to know anything. You don't have to make code. So they're doing it for you. It's a perfect upping the ante of the Android meme. Everything is here for you, and you don't have to do anything. But you'll be able to communicate and maintain phatic relationships with people. And then that affects the economy because it's a new environment.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently they're getting more, 85 million subscribers or engaged people, not even subscribers, just people signing up and using it. It's bigger than Google now.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of people interacting on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a temporary upgrade, a homeopathic replay of the 90s. But it's my space, my multi-spaces.
Yeah.
And it's become one space. That's, and you know, remember what goes with that? The rise of this phenomenon this past year goes with a famous line by Bush where he says, I make the decisions around here. He's perfectly expressing the subliminal effect of MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
MySpace.
Right. Although a couple days.
What pattern McLuhan make? People would go, look at Bush. What an egomaniac. What a blah, blah, blah. You know, really down at him saying it's my decision. They would not relate it to the larger technological environment they came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did what McLuhan did. Take something's happening over here, and another institution something's happening, and then noticing the new technology and how what's happening in those two institutions miming what the meaning of the new technology gives us.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. That's a good one.
Yeah,
I was just going to point out, though, that I did hear him on TV day before yesterday apologizing for the Bring It On statement. He actually, I heard him confess. It's the first time I've ever heard him confess a mistake. He said that was obviously arrogant to say that, and I apologize. Basically, that's what he said.
Yeah, but you're looking at what you think is a human being. There's a managed reason why they said that and why the Android meme had that image say that. It had nothing to do with Bush.
Yeah, it had to do with releasing pressure from all the people who are dissatisfied with him and using that as a reason to dislike him even more.
Yes, it was good he said it. That's why he said it 3 years ago, so he could have something create the disease and then offer the cure. He gave him something to release, so that was all planned.
Let's hope so. Let's hope they're that smart.
No, it's not a matter of smart. It's a matter of pressures. When you're on a boat and it's sinking, or you're on a boat and you're the skipper and you're running out of oil or something, you have to make certain decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And the environment dictates the conditions of those decisions. These guys do what they do not because they're smart. They're just being instinctive.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. In the year of, this is MySpace. MySpace. No, it's MySpace. Your space. MySpace. MySpace. Look at MySpace. Everybody's at MySpace. So to establish order, the Android meme had to say, no, I make the decisions around here. This is MySpace. That's a great pattern I just came up with.
Yeah. And, of course,
taking the most present words and images and trendiness and making a richer pattern out of it.
Well, that's what you do in a world where you make instead of match, because now everybody can go on MySpace and say, I'm the decision maker because I'm making it up.
And Big Brother had to say, no, we are the My. Big Brother represented by the White House.
Yeah.
So you can see that journalism cannot have a pattern like I just laid out. They must take particulars and incomplete notions and have a lot of sound and fury reacting pro or con about something. That limited range is all that the newspaper media can do, and that is marketable.
Yeah, all they want to do is attract Nielsen ratings and sell advertising.
Right. So they won't allow anybody to come up with a big pattern and everybody say, yeah, that's right, and then shut down the shop. They won't do that. Because you can't shut down the shop because people want to read newspapers or they want to watch movies. They want to engage these old media.
Well, you can't shut down the farms either. People will need to eat, and they would do the same thing, shutting off the media.
People need to eat the media.
Yeah. Well, more than that, it stimulates the economy and keeps it going. People literally would lose their ability to eat food if the media shut down.
Well, if the media was still there and they ran out of food, then maybe with the media environment and its instant communication, they'd be able to organize a new way of eating pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So that's, we don't want to think that's what people are operating under, that fear that they'll run out of food. If we did run out of food, people would immediately respond to it, and they'd respond differently than they would in the 30s, because it's got a whole different media environment.
But they wouldn't opt for it unless it was forced on them, because they can't see beyond the present paradigm.
Well, no, it's like the chemical body is only one quarter. They cannot dwell on one quarter of their concerns.
Yeah.
Because they got to feed the other bodies.
Right.
So, you see, I'm being the grammarian here. I'm finding a more accurate way to say something, if you agree with what I'm believing or proposing.
Right.
So I'm correcting what you're saying.
Right.
Saying a better way to say it.
Yeah.
That's what McLuhan's thesis was about.
Yeah. But there's only one person.
Eloquence and wisdom go together. It's not just some abstracting. If you need to be able to say it right, and today you have to include a lot of factors that aren't sayable in what you say.
Yeah, but there's only one person who fully understands what what you're saying, and that's you, and then there's a bunch of us who are groping it, trying to understand, but that's only a handful of people, so we can't expect everybody to collectively decide it's time to turn off the media.
No, and I don't think they will. So we're talking about the solution to what the mind wonders about. And the mind is largely verbal, and it's talking to itself. So we're saying, here's what the mind would say is the correct way of expressing the solution. But that's just one medium, the mind and the mouth. So that's why we can't implement it. But people like to hear it said. They call it poetry. They like to hear it massaged linguistically in an aesthetically pleasing way. So I'm trying to deal with the issues of discussing the problems of the world in an aesthetically pleasing way via the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
We can't apply it outside of that use that I just said it's for.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Okay, moving on to the next.
We're saying there's already an ecology going on.
There is an ecology, yeah. It's just a toxic ecology.
Well, we don't know how much is toxic. I mean, the latest news is that a major show on Fox TV said there is no global warming, and Al Franken and the liberals couldn't believe this because they've got 938 scholars who write about global warming, and none of them question it.
So maybe there is no ecology. It's a fake ecology that everybody's trying to prop up in order to prove their point.
Or it is an ecology. The global warming has to have the pro and cons as content for the media, but the real ecology is something responding to everything disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So we're well past the global warming fear. Mm-hmm. If we have disappeared in terms of communication, it's way more apocalyptic than anything that the Hope Eye predicted, or the Bible predicted, or any culture predicted.
Mm-hmm.
That's where Finnegan's Wake comes in. That's the most horrible, accurate prediction of our fate than any other cultural prophecy.
Hmm.
In the way it lays itself out.
Mm-hmm. So how did you manage to work your way through that nightmare? Because you sound okay, but I know you studied Finnegan's Wake pretty carefully, so you must have absorbed and swallowed it, and yet you swallowed the Finnegan's Wake hallucinogenic pill and survived the nightmare.
Yeah. And this book we're going through presents some of the materials used in processing Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
They helped. They added to the ramifications of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
What these four guys acted out is subsumed, like I have on the chart, within Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So how did I survive? I don't know.
Well,
Android Beam is very impressed, and that's why he keeps pointing at me.
Hmm. Yeah.
Like I say, me and Connie are the only ones who reappeared.
Mm-hmm.
After swallowing it.
Hmm.
We survived the whale.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You want to try the next?
The next quote.
Quote. Okay.
Which relates to what we're just saying.
Yeah, and it's from Keg Today. I'll bet that's one of McLuhan's most obscure books. I'll bet very few people have read and absorbed that material.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's it's a hidden environment within McLuhan land.
Mm-hmm. And it's Utopians and
Okay, Take Today, page 75, and this was co-written with Barry Nevitt.
Yeah. Very close to Bob Neverett. One of your associates. There's some kind of resonance going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So this quote perfectly just replays what we've been just saying.
Utopians and anti-utopians are always obsessed with a period preceding their own. Orwell's 1984 happened in 1930. Well, now, when I read that before we talked right now, what came into my mind was that all you can do when you're trying to predict the future is to look at the content of the past and then use that as a way of trying to project the content of the past into the future. But the future is, as we get new technological environments, it's unpredictable and surprising, so you're never going to get it right trying to use old content to predict new future scenarios.
Right. And so why not just turn off the future then for a while? But I just wanted to say that you see how I have the last sentence in the previous quote, and as our senses have gone outside us, Big Brother goes inside. Now, there's Big Brother. Everybody knows it's Orwellian. So then I put the next sentence in there to show you, well, McLuhan has a different idea of Orwell or Big Brother, because he's saying Orwell's Big Brother happened in 1930. So you see, that's positioned perfectly to get you to see that McLuhan's Big Brother is different than what you think Big Brother normally refers to. And then you have the next sentence from Verbi Vocal Visual.
I have a hard time with that. You know, I don't know, because I think Orwell's 1984 might have happened in 1930, but he took what happened in 1930 and created a paranoid projection of it, which was more than 1930. It was 1930 taken to a new extreme. I mean, in 1930, they didn't have the Orwellian surveillance and Big Brother.
Oh, yes, they did.
Yeah.
Joseph Conrad, in his novel Secret Agent, you know, written around 1905 or so, that described that Orwellian surveillance world.
Not for the average American citizen.
Well, it's British.
British.
Yeah, European. I don't know how many Americans read Joseph Conrad, but he was quite well known. But the thing is, the world of